All righty. This is the Mr. Nobody podcast. Season 2, episode 25. I'll leave this one untitled. In fact, let me title it Untitled. So I have a friend, a colleague, of whom I asked to give me some feedback about my show. He's nice enough to listen to the show. Not for me, but for his own jollies. But I trust his opinion. And if you're listening right now, I thank you. You know who you are. But do you know what you are? This was a very valuable thing to bring to the podcast, to my attention, and also point out some things that have been bothering me. For one thing, how much can anybody listen to the same song? Do you have a friend in your life who every time you get together with them, it's the same fucking thing? You get pretty sick of that. Now, granted, I have been mining this subject. I have been consciously not letting it go. But I think that has a shelf life. It has a point where I don't even want to hear about it. If I was listening to somebody else's podcast about how bummed out they were about their kid ODing, I would probably have a cutoff point where I would say, got it. Now, of course, I make all this music to bamboozle, entertain, and distract you from my one note tune. I like this tune a lot because it's so stupid. Normally, I don't reveal what I'm doing here, but let me just say those are animal sounds. Okay. So what am I going to do about it? Well, let me define it. Which implies that there should be some progression, right? Some some arc, some journey. And not just going around in circles. And not just going around in circles. Digging up the same ground. Saying, look. Look at this. Again. There is value in that. But it's got a shelf life. Jazz. I used to get something out of it. I used to give something to it. And I'm not sure anymore. Part of it was embracing that uncertainty. Seeing where my journey would take me. As if I was on a conveyor belt. And that the journey was not my responsibility. You know, one of the things my friend and artistic colleague told me is that the music can drown out my words. So let's lower this a little bit in real time. Yeah. Hi, is that better? That was fun. I even asked him, like, hey man, what would I do? He said he missed my humor. Because I do have a sick and rich sense of humor. And I told him I lost it. Which is only partially true. It's just, it's damaged. But every once in a while, I peek out and I remember the kind of person I used to be. Joyous and irreverent. That. He was kind enough to say to me, I'm worried about you stagnating. That's a flute a friend made for me. It's hard to make those flutes in tune. Anybody can burn holes into a hollow stick, but not everybody can create these beautifully well-intonated pieces of bamboo. They're each individual works of art. So I'm giving some thought to what the future of this work is? When to release the public from my torture chamber of my son's overdose death. Because I'm sure you have your own problems, tragedies, and heartbreak. Lower that a little bit. And to be honest, I use my son's... I use him. As an excuse. To feel justified about my... my shitty attitude. I still see reflections of myself, like in my training, when I work out with other people, I'm very... encouraging. And gentle. And I was like that with my son. Like, we would fight hard, but not to hurt each other or beat each other, but just to become better. And sometimes that requires losing, like on purpose. Allowing someone else to feel what it's like to beat me. And this is the collective magic of supporting each other. There was a band in San Francisco when I was a street urchin. They were from Japan, and their name was Ogiyochi. I'm saying that with a question mark because I hope I'm remembering it correctly. Ogiyochi. I'm probably saying something pornographic. And I asked him what that name meant. What does that mean, Ogiyochi? What does that mean, Ogiyochi? The lead guitar player said, it means to pull together. Lower this a little bit. Did you hear me say I was going to lower the background a little bit? I love playing the nylon string guitar. Sometimes I listen back to something I recorded, I don't remember playing that. Because they're improvisations, I don't retain them. There's so much I could do better, yet no. So, Ogiyochi, the sense of pulling together, they liken to being on a rowboat. Like Vikings would row together, pull together. So stagnation is where a living ecosystem dies. process. It's not a good smelling process. And I wouldn't have thought about it in the same way had I not had that feedback. Who said it? That feedback is the breakfast of champions. My friend was worried that he would offend me, but I told him it was just the opposite. That in fact, feedback is like a freeing. It's a nutrient. You know when it's right. He was concerned that I would stagnate, that my pond that was alive would become full of dead things, that my story would begin to die, stagnate. And failure is really success, because it just means that you're doing something. Overlap it with something unexpected. Okay. Have you ever heard the quote that the truth is not eloquent? And that eloquence is not truthful. I can't remember who owns that quote. I'll just turn that down so you can hear me. But the idea now belongs to us. So something that's true doesn't need pretty words or artificial beautifying. Maybe the word semblance or verisimilitude come to mind. And when something has all this the word isn't floral, but it's extemporaneous shit attached to it, like gingerbread. I'll give you an example. I'm reading a book right now that's all language. It's all full of how clever the writer can represent objects mostly. But the things that the author is representing are not really that important. They're overly developed details showing off what this particular author can do with words. As if a phrase of music had tons of extemporaneous floraling away from its main idea. And it's quite frankly difficult to read, and I have to read it. It's annoying for something I'm doing, and I'm trying to get through it, but it's kind of obnoxious. It's a fucking drag. And juxtapose this against another book that I read that was probably one of the most beautiful, honest breakthroughs of the human reason for being, the suffering, the alleviation of suffering and injustice. Those words were beautiful, but there was not anything unnecessary. There was no fat. There was no bullshit. There was no showing off. That author even referred to this book as a sketch, that the subject matter was so painful, so disturbing, that all he could do was attempt to write about it. You could hear the humility I shit you not, in his words, this book that I'm talking about has changed me. Whereas the one I was talking about before that has all this crafty language is boring. It's like somebody who won't stop talking about themselves. I gotta get to the end, but they don't really have anything to say because I'm committed. I'm obligated to do so. But you, beautiful listener, are not obligated to listen to this. However, I do feel an obligation to you to not be a drag, to move myself, to not be a fucking bore, to move myself forward, to challenge myself. Not sure if that's the right word, because that's just a universal human. But you know how, like, something turns itself inside out, inside out, inside out? Yes. That's what I'm trying to do here. And not sit in one place as that happens, but, like, to let that undulation, that roiling, that inside-out-ness, enlighten my condition. Because my condition has been one of stubborn anger, hatred. That's a strong word. Feel the hate that I feel for drug dealers and for Mexican cartels, and even for people who destroy themselves. It's expensive, and I'm not sure it's warranted. I don't even know. Where does my confusion begin? Not for sure. And where does my hatred belong? And then underneath this anger and this bitterness, I have this sadness. It's like I lost my kingdom. It's very male-centric, like the way that we worship a god in the West that lost his son. What if God had a daughter? Because I have a daughter. And my daughter is like a savior to me. Yet, still, in my story, the prince died on the battlefield of life. Please forgive me, I've been reading a book about medieval warfare, and the Battle of Hastings was my last pleasure read. I'm not obligated to read this book. This was one that I find really important and fascinating. The question looms, what really happened? Well, one thing we know is that under the very able diplomatic and strategically brilliant King Harold Godwinson, the Anglo-Saxons defeated an invading army of Vikings days before the Battle of Hastings. So after this fierce battle with the Viking invaders in the north, the Anglo-Saxons were a victorious army. They were at their peak of promise. And they limped back to York, which was 200 miles south, only to receive word that the Normans had already invaded in Hastings, near Hastings. Harold had to muster his exhausted army He had to get troops raised on the way. And he was the king, Harold Godwinson. He was even a disputed king. The Vikings were fighting against him along with Harold's brother. So that's the kind of shit he was dealing with. The Normans, they showed up with mounted cavalry in heavy armor, something the Anglos didn't have. And the Anglo-Saxons didn't have any of that. They had no attack tanks like mounted cavalry. They were the equivalent of tanks. And the Norman army, which was composed of several different groups from Normandy, what is now France, had like 3,000 of these mounted, heavily armored knights. And they also had archers to protect the knights. And the Anglo-Saxons took a defensive position, and they didn't have archers like the Normans up on a hill, side of a hill, and made a wall with their shields, a shield wall. And they repelled the Normans for hours until they didn't. The Normans started using their archers to shoot the rear of Harold's army. And eventually, they killed the Anglo-Saxon king. They killed Harold. Back then, if you were a king or a prince, you fought. You were part of the actual battle. Once they kill the king or the leader, it demoralized them. The demoralization of the troops sets in. So sometimes they would even spread rumors the king is dead. But they did that earlier in the battle, and Harold had to show up. That did happen in this case. The Normans, they spread a rumor that Harold was dead. William the Bastard, what a bastard, defeated and killed most of those people, most of those men. And within a few hours, the entire structure of that country disintegrated. Its living structure. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that England was an ecosystem. Angleland is a conquered country. It had an ecosystem of its own. And the Normans built a castle, a fortress in every single area that they could to control the people, to let them know that they were conquered. And the people that used to own that country or live there for 1,000 years became vassals, second, third class citizens to these overlords. It was written in this book that on that day, the flower of Anglo-Saxon nobility was extinguished. And when I read that, I had a sense of what that felt like. That I have lost my kingdom. That I have lost my kingdom. We're all so soft these days compared to what life was like for people then. So I felt I should toughen up and realize that history is full of princes that will never become king. Mr. Nobody, out.